Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now. Save big money at
Menards. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 65 of The Bowery Boys, Spooky Stories of Old New York.
Hey, it's The Bowery Boys.
Hey.
The Bowery Boys is brought to you by Eurocheapo.com. Eurocheapo editors personally visit and review the best budget hotels in Europe. Now with hotels in New York City. On the web at Eurocheapo.com.
Hello there, and welcome to the Bowery Boys. My name is Greg Young.
And I'm Tom Myers.
Last year, one of our most popular podcasts was our Ghost Stories of New York, so we are doing our little sequel this week. This year, we're calling it Spooky Stories of New York.
Right, because there aren't always ghosts in these, but on this cool, crisp October night, we're letting our minds wander off into spooky places in New York City.
Chills are running up my arm here. We have the room decorated with candles and little pumpkins.
Yeah, Greg brought in a squash. It's very, very festive and kind of spooky here on the recording table.
Obviously, something is conspiring to stop this show because we've had a breakdown in one of our microphones and our mixing board. We had no internet connection there for a while. So.
Really, the spirits are working against us. It's almost like they don't want us to make this podcast.
I feel like there's a poltergeist in the room. What if some of our papers begin just to fly out the window? Then I'm just going to run.
My head started spinning around.
Then we might just abruptly stop the show. Before we jump into this, however, we have a decidedly non-spooky thing to tell you. We're having our first live event this Tuesday. If you are in New York City, we would love it if you would come by. It is a New York City trivia night. We are hosting it in association with the Municipal Arts Society.
One of New York's oldest and finest cultural institutions.
It'll be 2 hours of hot New York City trivia. Everyone will be broken up into teams. Come and bring your friends, and there'll be prizes.
Right, and Greg said it's this Tuesday, October 14th, 2008, at 6:30 p.m.
At Common Ground. That is at 206 Avenue A, between 12th and 13th Streets.
We'd love to see you there.
Yeah, it should be a blast, but now back to this show. It's all about
spooky tales
of old New York.
Okay, Greg, we're all sitting around shivering, ready to be spooked.
The windows open, wind lightly blowing your curtains. Well, Tom, if you've ever walked down a New York street, like, you know, really late at night, I'm sure you have.
Three
in the morning.
Many times.
Down a street, like, say, of old brownstones, these old, beautiful, rustic buildings, each one that has 1,000 different stories to tell. But if you ever gave it thought sometimes that, like, for all these nostalgic things that you think and you see these buildings, there's actually a lot of things that happened behind those doors that aren't so nostalgic, that aren't so rustic. Behind a lot of those walls and a lot of those doors are some tragic stories, some sinister, sometimes maybe even some evil stories behind those very doors. Have you even gotten a chill down your spine, like thinking that you may have seen something out of the corner of your eye, maybe just like in a stairwell or in a window of just like an old, really fancy turn of the century building? You'd turn and it wasn't a face. You thought it was a face, but you're still not sure. So it's with that mindset.
You're creeping me out here, Greg.
that I want you, it's with that mindset, Tom, that I want our listeners and you, and when I hear your stories, I will be in this mindset as we go into these tales. The first one is, in fact, on a street of brownstones. In fact, has often been called one of the most beautiful blocks in Manhattan, but I can call this building one of the most haunted places in Manhattan. It's so frightening, it's so unspeakable, that it has its own nickname, the House of Death.
Why is it called the House of Death?
Well, you've heard a lot of stories about, you know, a ghost haunting whatever, a hotel or a theater. The House of Death is haunted by 22 ghosts.
Oh my word.
At least 22 ghosts.
That's like a hotel of death.
It's a hotel of death. A hostel of death, if you will. You know, my observation, well, just before I jump into why, I just need to tell you, because I went by this building just a couple days ago, you know, as it was getting dark and the streets were kind of empty. And curiously enough, all the street lamps up and down the street had just turned on, except for the one that was right in front of this building. Now, this neighborhood, this block, it's really one, it's an old neighborhood of astounding wealth. Right there at the corner, just a few steps away, is the Church of the Ascension, which was built in 1841 and was designed by our friend Richard Upjohn, who I mentioned in last week's episode as designing the gate at Greenwood Cemetery.
And what's the intersection? Is that 6th Avenue?
Or? That's 5th Avenue. The Church of the Ascension is actually on 5th Avenue. Uh-huh. So that's just a few steps away. So there's all these beautiful brownstones up and down. There's some great James Renwick brownstones just up the block, including places that Marcel Duchamp has lived in, Dashiell Hammett, and more recently Kathleen Turner lived just on this block. 14 West 10th is just a little different. It's actually blocked by some trees. So all the other buildings are just these beautiful, fabulous buildings, but this is blocked. It was built in 1856, and it's a Gothic Revival home. Now, it had a very famous person that lived in it, Tom. From the year 1900 to 1901, Mark Twain lived there.
Wow, for now, 1 year.
And he lived actually in two or three places throughout Manhattan. This is the only extant place that's still standing in Manhattan that Twain actually lived in. He had actually come back from Europe on a famous lecture tour. Most of his famous works by this time had already been written, but he was, you know, kind of living off his own glory by this time. The term House of Death actually comes from a chapter title in Huckleberry Finn, the chapter title being The House of Death Floats By. Now, when he lived there in 1900, he thought the house was haunted. He claimed it himself.
And did he have the whole house? Was it a residential unit, or was it divided up into apartments or something like that?
He was leasing the house, and he lived there with his wife. It's a very big building, so if he did live there by himself, he would have had a lot of space to see ghosts. So Twain ended up moving out, in fact, to a house in the area in the Bronx that we know as Wave Hill today. But the house must have some kind of a paranormal pull or something, if you will. As if maybe like anyone who's ever lived there eventually goes to haunt it, because Twain himself is now known to haunt the house at 14 West 10th Street. In particular, he haunts the stairwell and has been seen in the stairwell, slowly strolling up the steps. Or, you know, maybe imagine if you were visiting someone or lived there now, you're walking up the steps and you look up at the very top and there's just a ghostly,
creepy Mark Twain standing there,
figure in white standing there, just sort of looking down at you. So throughout the 20th century, there's been a lot of very strange occurrences there, according to legend. There was a murder-suicide in that building in that very decade after Twain moved out. There was a female poet who died there in the 1940s. It was so renowned for being haunted that in the 1950s, a psychic was actually brought in to sort of confirm some of these rumors. Now, if you believe in psychics or not, you know, it doesn't really matter, but it's basically to this point in the 19...
The psychic confirmed? It was, I mean, the
oh,
the verdict
she confirmed.
Was,
yeah. She confirmed. And it's, you know, at least reputation-wise, it was so known as a ghost house that that she was brought in. Now, recently, this has even been a site of a horrible tragedy very recently, and probably one that you remember from the news. In 1987, there was a call made and the police came over to this building, and when they, for a disturbance that was happening in an apartment.
Because it had been divided up into apartments.
By this time, yes. So the police came to the door, and a woman opened, and at first the police thought that she was a really old woman, but in fact she had just been savagely abused. Oh. And so the police opened the door, and there's a man standing with a lifeless body of a young girl. In fact, this is the story of poor Lisa Steinberg, who was thrown against the wall and was savagely beaten by her father, Joel. And the woman in this case, her name was Hedda Nussbaum, and she was a former editor in New York City. This case took national headlines because it really put a focus on child abuse. And this poor girl was a foster child, and she wasn't really legally supposed to be with him, but he was living there, and he treated her and the whole family just absolutely horribly. So she ended up dying. He ended up going to prison and spending 17 years there, but he was released in 2004. So this is a very, it's a very heart-wrenching story, and it brought a lot of attention to child abuse and became sort of a clarion call for a lot of people. By the way, I went to a message board, and as recently as 2 months ago, some ghost hunters had gone there. I mean, whether they were amateur ghost hunters, I don't know what it means to be a professional ghost hunter, but they were ghost hunters nonetheless, had gone there, and they had claimed that they had taken some pictures inside the building, and that some of the pictures had ghost orbs and faces, that they could even see faces. I should add, this is a private residence. We'll be talking about a couple businesses a little bit later that would be delighted if you stopped by and tried to investigate this ghost story. But this is a private residence. I mean, the sidewalk is free for all, but, you know, don't...
And it's sort of well known, is it, in the New York tourism circle that this is a haunted residence?
It is one of the most haunted places and has been for over 100 years. So
The people who live there know about this?
They all know about it. They probably were told. Some of them might have even moved in because of it.
Sure.
There's a little Mark Twain plaque, but it's very difficult to see because it's all sort of shaded and gloomy.
Right, because the light doesn't work.
Well, it didn't when I was there. So that, my friends, is
that
the House of Death.
Spooky, spooky story.
The New York Times calls BritBox the best of British telly. Stream acclaimed original series, including Payback, starring Peter Mullen, Stonehouse, starring Matthew McFadyen, and Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, starring Jason Isaacs. Plus, discover powerful new series like The Three Little Birds and the return of BAFTA-winning drama, Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Lighten us up here, Tom, but give us in the spook
realm. Well, I'm going to talk about Dorothy Parker and the Round Table.
All right. So you're going to take us back to we're talking more about writers.
Before we talk about this table, we should just mention the hotel itself, the Algonquin, which is at 59 West 44th. Now, the Algonquin opened in 1902 and was originally called the Puritan. It wouldn't keep that reputation for very long. In fact, Frank Case, who would later take it over and was the general manager early on, advised the owner to change the name to Algonquin once he kind of realized that the Algonquin tribe was one of the first tribes on the island.
So they were actually doing it for a historical reason?
You know, the Indians were there before the Puritans. So there was a nod to history.
Okay.
Frank Case took over the hotel in 1907. He would buy it in 1927 for $1 million. Now, when he took it over, many of the things, the traditions, the sort of aura of the Algonquin come mm-hmm. from this era when Frank Case ran it. And he ran it until he died in 1946.
Well, it has a very trapped in time feel to certain parts of it, which I really like.
And it banks on that. And, you know, because it was a meeting place for writers and poets and editors and actors and playwrights and such, it became famous in the literary circles. In fact, for a long time, traveling writers were able to spend a night for free at the Algonquin if they would just leave an autographed copy of their book.
Oh, very clever. Because, you mean, if you roll the dice, one of them is eventually going to become quite famous.
But in 1919, a group of these sort of poets and writers and playwrights...
Because by then, a lot of people had been there and very familiar with it. It's become a little bit
it was central. I mean, there it was on 44th Street in the center of Midtown.
Right.
A group gathered and called themselves the Vicious Circle. This group included people such as Dorothy Parker...
Mm-hmm.
Harold Ross, who was the editor and founder of the New Yorker magazine, George Kaufman, playwright, Robert Benchley, an actor, Alexander Wolcott, the New York Times drama critic. Harpo Marx was a member.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Actor, writer, card shark.
He's not who
Harpo
you,
Marx.
He's not who you picture around the table.
And, well, his brother Groucho actually didn't like it. He wasn't into the word games and the sort of self-aggrandizing shenanigans that took place there. And I think a lot of self-congratulatory spirits about the table as people imbibed in spirits. And, and so people starting in 1919 knew that they could go to this table, which at first was a rectangular table in the Oak Room, which was the restaurant there, and would later become, as the group got larger, it was moved to the Rose Room, and they were put at a big round table. This was a place where people could go for lunch, and it started in 1919 and continued on for 10 years. By the 1930s, the group had kind of piddled out, or people had gotten over it, or some people had moved out of New York. Some had died.
Some had died, right?
Yeah, sure. So Frank Case, the manager, when he was asked about this, you know, whatever happened to the Vicious Circle? He said, well, what became of the Reservoir, 5th and 42nd? These things don't last forever. They don't last forever, but some of the spirits do. Some of the spirits of these celebs.
Some of these jovial. So just as Mark Twain may be haunting downtown, it's too bad he can't take some sort of a ghost subway.
And a ghost train.
A ghost train and come up and visit some of these talents at the Algonquin.
Indeed, because it's said that today the ghost of Dorothy Parker, of Wolcott, even of Harpo Marx, are still around. Guests claim to see the ghosts in their guest rooms, walking up and down the hallways. During a renovation of the Rose Room, everything was being respected except a framed photo of Dorothy Parker, which fell on its face when they moved the round table.
And so hotel guests would sometimes see some
hotel
of these
guests
people.
Have seen some of these walking up and down the hallways. In fact, it's just taken as fact that these ghosts haunt the Algonquin, that every New Year's Eve at the stroke of midnight, the kitchen staff comes out banging pots and pans to make a clamor and scare away the spirits for another year.
I don't know if I'd want to scare them away. I'd imagine like these, you know, dandies with their ghost martinis and ghost slippers walking through the hallways.
I think that they'd be quite a lot of fun. No, I don't think I'd want to scare them away either. I mean, this group played charades over lunch, and they were playing a game also simply called the I Can Give You a Sentence game, where you would throw somebody a word and they had to come back at you quickly with a sentence. Dorothy Parker famously, Greg, I know this is off, this is like the furthest thing from spooky,
yeah.
But she was famously given the word horticulture.
And what was her answer?
You can lead a whore to culture, but you can't make her think. That's Dorothy Parker, and I'll have what she's having.
Well, and hopefully she is haunting there, and I'll throw her a word if I see her. It might be a scream, but she'll have a retort for it, I'm sure.
So can you bring us back into spooky territory?
Well,
I only have Dorothy falling off a wall.
Well, well, I am going to definitely take you to spooky territory. And, you know, we've been very Manhattan-centric here. We're going to take a ferry, pay the ferryman, and go to Staten Island for the very next ghost story. Mm. Staten Island is, by the way, known as one of the most haunted places in all of New England. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So the story that I'm about to tell, it's a story about family. It's a holiday story. It's something you may want to share with your family around the holidays, if you hate them. It's centered at a small cemetery. It's in this in northwest Staten Island, in this neighborhood that's called Graniteville. It was a small town in Staten Island. You know, sadly, this cemetery is by a four-lane street, and there's like a Rite Aid right next to it, so it sort of takes away the ghostly feel to it. There are have been some sightings of a woman named Emmeline Van Pelt Houseman, and I believe she may be holding her daughter Ann Eliza, and they were victims of who was later called in the press the Witch of Staten Island. Now, Staten Island in 1837 was not a part of New York. It was a fishing outpost of about 10,000 people. A man by the name of George Houseman, he had a house here. He was a captain of an oyster ship, and he was currently away in Virginia. His sister, Polly Bodine, was staying with George's wife, who was Emmeline, and George's young daughter, and his young daughter, Annalisa, who was 20 months old. So Polly was staying with them because it was winter time. As a matter of fact, our story starts in Christmas of 1843. Two young boys were coming home from a skating party when they saw some smoke coming out of the house of George Houseman. So they rang the alarm and all the townspeople came and they burst down the door and they're all thinking like, well, luckily no one will be home. I mean, it's Christmas. They're probably out doing something. They're out visiting people. Then they put out the fire. The house is still filled with smoke. It's very, very cold. But they look into the kitchen and then there's some baskets of pumpkins, like the pumpkin right there on the table, pumpkins and things. But then there's something right next to it. It's a scene of completely grisly horror. And I'm sorry, this is going to be a little gory. It's George's wife, Emmeline, and she's been attacked with an axe. Her arms have been broken. Her throat has been cut. Her little daughter is laying right next to her with her skull crushed. The bed sheets inside are covered in blood. Polly has disappeared. Suspicion had immediately went to Polly. Now, why exactly? She was sort of considered a wanton woman, a fallen woman, if you will. She had a very spurious reputation. She had separated from her husband. Her son was an apprentice at a drugstore on Canal Street, in 1843, a fairly new street.
Newish, yeah, 30 years old.
And his employer was her lover. These rumors spread that she had been seen in town selling silverware that had the initials EH on it for Emmeline Houseman. And later that day, she was seen spending some money on a green hooded cape and green veils. So obviously, these stories spread. On New Year's Eve, just a week later, Polly would actually be standing on the landing of the precursor to the Staten Island Ferry. She was drunk. Someone recognized her by her, quote, long hooked nose. Keep in mind, these are all from very biased news reports. So she was captured and she was sent to county jail. When she was in jail, while she was there, Polly gave birth to a stillborn baby. So naturally, because of all of these different things, that spread into all the newspapers, and it was a huge...
But did people know she was pregnant when she was hauled off to jail?
I'm not quite sure on that. They make it appear as if it just happened, as if she's just some sort of evil, you know? I mean...
Gotcha.
So I would imagine that you would know, but for the first trial, one of the first reporters that covered this story was a reporter from Philadelphia by the name of Edgar Allan Poe. And he said that, I mean, he had, you know, because writing back then, you could sort of infer your own opinion into the stories. He basically said that he thought that she was guilty, but that they would screw it up in the Staten Island simple court system. Curiously, though, George Houseman, now this is Polly's brother and the husband of the woman who had been horribly murdered and the father of the poor girl that died.
Gotcha.
He actually stood by Polly this entire time. He claimed, "My wife and child are gone. That is past. I can get another wife. I can never get another sister."
And curious.
In fact, he did get another wife later, and from Virginia. Edgar Allan Poe was actually kind of right, because the first case was a little botched. The first trial was totally botched. So a second trial was held against mm-hmm. Polly Bodine. It was held in Manhattan. So naturally, it was much greater fanfare, and all the newspapers covered it. The case was particularly popular with women, and it was sort of seen as scandalous at the time, because there was some very salacious details being thrown out during this. Who else gets into the picture here? This case was so notorious that P.T. Barnum, who just happened to be opening his American Museum right up the street from the trial, had an entire wax homage to her, and that's where the title The Witch of Staten Island comes from. But he represented her as a woman who was like 80 years old. I mean, like an old, withered hag, and that she had an axe, and like there were body parts, like, you know, wax. It was like a scene of gruesome terror. Polly, being, of course, the trial of the century, she had a superstar representation, one of the biggest lawyers in New York at the time. And Tom, guess what his name was? His name was Clinton DeWitt.
Not DeWitt Clinton.
No. Clinton DeWitt. He was
a very... did they run out of names in New York City or something? It's like a recycled name.
Well, it's like, I mean, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I hope he was named in honor. I mean, in honor of the great statesman.
Are you sure there wasn't a comma?
There's no. I swear to God. Clinton DeWitt was his name. Anyway, this trial was also even more botched because it was just there was like way too much attention to it. You know, witnesses were changing their stories. All these rumors kept getting thrown in and treated like truth. It was declared a mistrial. She was convicted, and then they threw the whole thing out. So they had to have one final trial. They moved it out to New Jersey because they couldn't find anyone who didn't know anything about the trial. So they actually had to move it to another state.
Sure.
And so they moved to New Jersey, and Polly was found innocent. Her first words to her lawyer were, "Can't I sue Barnum now?" So, but fortunately, not surprisingly, her reputation was ruined. Polly returned to her home, and she rarely left her house, and lived back in Staten Island for almost 50 years. She would die in 1892. However, the real murderer was never really found. They never found the real murderer of Emmeline. There's actually a lot of modern crime solvers who have looked into this tale and actually do think that Polly really was the murderer and that she really did it. So today they do say that the ghosts of Emmeline and her daughter still walk the cemetery, and in the area where Emmeline's house used to be, where Polly had, you know, reportedly murdered them, there has recently been seen a vapor in the shape of a person just across the street from that area. They claim it's a vapor, a ghostly vapor. And people wonder, could that be the real murderer? And there you have the story of the Witch of Staten Island. Okay, Tom, to end this spooky extravaganza, why don't you take us back to Manhattan and further back in time?
Well, and I do mean well... I'm going to tell you about the murder at Manhattan Well.
A well in Manhattan? We must be really going back a little bit.
We're going back to 1799, and we are back in Soho now, and we're going to Spring Street, the intersection of Spring and Green.
It's a very fashionable neighborhood, lots of clothing stores.
Today it is, and I walked by this intersection on my way home from work tonight just to see if I could find the Manhattan Well.
Where it was.
Where mm-hmm. this took place. There's still a long alleyway that takes you back to the scene of the crime. And remember that there was a whole swampland because everybody was in the southern tip, of course, of Manhattan Island.
This was all very swampy, marshy stuff here.
And from
this area.
DeWayne Street, right by City Hall today, north up to what is today's Spring Street, that was a big swamp called Lispinard's Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
Water flowed up from the Collect Pond, which was on this piece of land up toward this area in the northeast corner where they would dig this well. The Collect Pond itself would be drained in 1803 and filled in, and of course Canal Street built a few years later. But before that, if we just rewind to 1799, lots of people lived in boarding houses, including our friend Elma Sands.
Elma Sands.
Elma Sands was 22, and she lived in a boarding house run by her cousin, Catherine Ring, and her husband at Franklin and Greenwich Street, so sort of Tribeca City Hall area. So Catherine was a milliner. She ran a millinery business.
A millinery.
She was a millinery.
Hat maker.
And she had 20 women working for her, including Elma. In Catherine's house, she had some other family members, like Elma. Her husband's sister lived there, as well as a young guy named Levi Weeks. Now, Levi was a carpenter, a young guy. He lived upstairs in a room with his apprentice. This was normal back in the day to live with your apprentice, and in the case of Levi, to even share the same bed. So
I'm getting close to your supervisor, aren't you?
I think there are laws against this sort of thing today. Levi and Elma were both living in the same house, and they were engaged secretly to be married. Neither of them wanted to get the word out, but everybody kind of knew because Elma had already spread the word to Catherine and to her sister.
When you're in a millinery, the news spreads quickly.
Quicker
in a millinery.
Than a ribbon around a hat.
Yes.
Now, this house was just 5 minutes away by sleigh. There was a one-horse sleigh. It would take 5 minutes to go up Greenwich Street, cut across Spring Street to get to this very well, the Manhattan Well. So on the night of Sunday, December 22nd, 1799, at 8 p.m., Levi had come home, Elma was already at home, and they boarded a sleigh to run off and get married. This was the night that they were going to get married. Elma had been sick, she had a cold, and so Catherine had instructed her to run off to a neighbor's and get a muff for her hands to keep her warm. Catherine was a little bit nervous about this. She wasn't quite sure what struck her as odd, except that they had been, you know, moving around in the night. They had already been sleeping together upstairs. It's documented. It would come out in the courts later.
Ooh.
Unfortunately, Greg, they didn't go off to get married that night. Elma would actually never return to the house on Greenwich Street. Levi, in fact, even denied that he ever left with Elma. He said that she went upstairs to her room, and in fact, it's true, Catherine did see Elma go up the stairs to her room, and Levi was downstairs, and then Catherine went off, and she tended to her own child who was upstairs, and she heard the latch on the door go shut, and the two, well, she just assumed had gone off together. Later on in trial, several witnesses would say that they saw Elma actually on a sleigh with some other men take off at the same time.
Curious.
In fact, a homeless woman who had fallen and hurt herself, and in the process of this entire thing, Elma had stopped and asked if this woman was okay, and a man had beckoned her back to the site. Come on, we're in a hurry. That's all we know about that. Until at about 8:15 or 8:30, there were neighbors who had already gone to sleep around the well on Spring Street, and they heard somebody screaming, "Murder! Oh, murder! Save me!" And they looked out the window, and they saw a man standing at Manhattan Well. They didn't see a woman, but they saw a man kind of over the well. At 10 p.m., about an hour and a half later, Levi, There's a knock at the door. He opens it, and it's his apprentice coming in for the night. Catherine has come down the stairs, and she sees Levi there. Levi doesn't quite look right. Catherine says, "Where's Elma?" And Levi says, "Oh, I don't. Where is Elma? I don't know. Is she Elma?" Catherine thinks maybe she's gone off to return the muff to the neighbor. On Monday, the next day, neighbors notice that there's a track from a single sleigh going by the well, and there's also a board missing on the top of the well that had been covering it to keep it from freezing. Now, 5 days later, there are boys playing by the well, playing ball, and they found a muff floating on top of the well. Meanwhile, Levi had approached the family, was trying to get the family to sign off on a statement that there was nothing between him and Elma, that they weren't lovers of any kind. Well, the family knew better and refused to sign this. On January 2nd, just a couple days later, Elias Ring, the man of the house, took matters into his own hand and went to the well and pulled out Elma's body with a pole.
So she had died several days before that, and we assume on that fateful night.
Levi claimed that he was with his well-connected brother and his family the whole time, and that he had documented proof of where he was at all times, and that there was no ability for him to take off, and he never left with Elma in the first place. And he had some high-powered lawyers, Greg. He had hired the defensive team of Hamilton and Burr. Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr.
No, wait, they both were... So Levi obviously clearly had a lot of money.
Yes,
he
his
really
family,
did.
He came from a pretty wealthy family, and his brother ran a well-connected construction company. It was a very unlikely event, and in fact, it seems that historians have been digging into why this would have... They're not surprised that Hamilton would have been representing him, because he was from a well-connected family, etc. Burr, they're a little bit more curious about, but I think it was an election year, and that maybe it was good for...
To get latched onto a case like this, it could be get a lot of attention.
It was high profile, and so they worked together on this, and they devised and concocted really a sort of scandalous defense for him, saying that poor Elma was actually promiscuous and, in fact, suicidal, and that there was no evidence linking Levi to it. And the evidence about them being engaged was not allowed in the court. And the judge actually wouldn't let it be presented at all. So the jury never heard it. And at the end of the testimony, the judge looked at the jury and pretty much instructed them to rule in favor of the defense. And our Levi was let off the hook.
So do we know who then murdered our Miss Sands?
We pretty much assume that it was Levi, and he got out of it. according to a story, Catherine Ring, when she heard about the jury's verdict, pointed at the team of Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton and the judge and screamed, "If thee dies a natural death, I shall think there is no justice in heaven."
Wow, and very, very weird considering what happened to Alexander Hamilton.
And the judge, who in 1829 left his room at a hotel and was never seen again. There's a building that's now under construction. It's a loft apartment building. Right now, the bottom floor is under construction. It's kind of a spooky grayish green. There's a little alleyway behind it that leads to the back of the restaurant, which is attached to this building, which is a Manhattan Bistro.
Manhattan Bistro, yes.
Right? But down this alleyway, you will find the approach to the well.
And she haunts there to this day?
Elma is seen wandering up and down Spring Street.
I've heard that she even haunts the Manhattan Bistro. That's some good, weird, spooky history stuff that you can just wander down the street and find. Thank you, Tom. And thank you guys for listening to our spooky Halloween edition of The Bowery Boys. We also have some exciting news for you iTunes folk out there. If you've noticed, we've taken a lot of our old episodes off of our regular feed. We are starting a brand new feed called Bowery Boys Archive, which you can now get it on iTunes. And that essentially is all of our old episodes, but we've cleaned them up, we've remixed them, we've uploaded them to like new, more superior sound. If you'd like to, you know, revisit some of them, or if you haven't heard them, those will be up soon.
So thank you for joining us on our spooky night together.
Have a great New York week, whether you live here or not.
See you next week.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning Shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.